And we're back. Welcome to No Direction Beyond, your Starfinder news, reviews, and interviews podcast. I'm one of your hosts, Jefferson J. Thacker, also known as Param, and I'm joined by...
Alexander Agunis, the Everyman Gamer.
And I'm James. I write Code Switch.
Today is going to be an interesting debate topic, or at least educational, as Alex will try to...
use the E-word, Param.
As Alex will try to present his argument that the Pact Worlds are a corporate dystopia. But before we jump into that, we do have a little bit of news we have to talk about, but we only have little to talk about it. Paizo on their stream just a few minutes ago, or probably a little bit over an hour ago, announced that there will be a Starfinder playtest for some new classes starting on Monday, and no other details. So there's not much we can talk about on this, but hey, that's exciting news, and hopefully, well, we'll find out on Monday.
Just when you thought that your Paizo playtests were over, they just pull you back in.
Oh, yes. Oh, man, it is so much the playtesting. Everything's in early access or beta or playtesting, even the fully released Fallout games.
Dude.
Aww, I enjoy that one.
I enjoy it too, but still, my character gets his arms elongated to 20 feet long for half the time.
Yeah, James, he needs that for apples.
But James... Mm-hmm. Do you think this is going to be like a Pathfinder First Edition playtest? Will the classes in their playtest form be playable in Starfinder Society?
Wait, you mean Pathfinder? Ooh. Oh, like when they did it for the occult classes?
Yeah, like Occult Adventures and the Advanced Class Guide. Actually, whenever First Edition did a Pathfinder Society organized play thing, they always, or whenever First Edition made a new class and put a playtest out, organized play always had rules to play it. So I wonder... Are we going to be able to play these classes in organized play? Because I think we might see a dramatic shift in our local PFS if that happens. We could see all new classes. Look at James's face of excitement.
I know. SFS. I also think maybe, hopefully they do a couple rounds instead of just dumping it. Because, man, I was really only playing during the occult class playtest that I was, like, aware that it was a thing. And what was it? The occultist.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. The occultist had some power issues.
Yeah, it definitely did. And I remember one of our venture lieutenant had an occultist character, and he was just like, I'm just going to keep this until they take it away from me.
Yeah, he kind of single-handed Thornkeep for us.
That was something. He stopped playing that character after he did that, if you remember.
Yeah, because at one point he looked at his dice, he goes, I kind of feel bad.
Yeah, it was really funny. But they've done multiple rounds of playtesting for every class that I can think of that I've been a part of. Like, they did it for the Magus and the ACG and the Occult.
Oh, and the Vigilante, that's right.
Oh, but we don't talk about that one. No, that's the Shifter we don't talk
yeah,
about.
Yeah, no, the Vigilante got supplanted.
Yeah, we could talk about the Vigilante. The Vigilante playtest was actually good. The final product is cool, you know. But also, the Shifter didn't get a playtest, so it is what it is. I am extremely optimistic for Starfinder playtesting.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I have a lot of faith in the Starfinder team to do good work, and I think it will be much fun when we find out what they are. But that's all we can talk about on this one, gang.
No, but before we get off the topic, one of our former venture lieutenants is in chat. It's Imperiosaur, who was one of the Philadelphia venture lieutenants before they moved to Boston.
Uh-huh.
And I forgot that both of our venture lieutenants made occultuses and cheesed the heck out of them.
It's kind of funny because the occultist currently has a power problem, just the wrong end of that stick.
The occultist is great if you go weapon. I've seen people do silly stuff with that. I make my weapon do whatever I want.
Yeah. Either they're topping the charts or they're just 6 feet under.
They are the Zenyatta of classes in the occult book.
Yeah, what was it? It was system mastery was the term coined during 3E on material that you had to be very fluent in the system in order to use correctly.
Yeah.
Very famously, the toughness feat was called out as being a part of that system mastery plan, like intentionally, as being an underpowered feat that people would initially think was good and then only learn later that it was a trap.
That seems bad.
That also seems bad, which is why that's not supposed to be a part of any sort of Pathfinder or Starfinder design, at least, you know, not intentionally.
Yeah. Well, I mean, prone shooters always happen.
Oh, yeah. You've put out enough material and something's going to break.
I mean, for some classes, it's, you know, like a pretty good increase. Regardless, this is Starfinder. I'm thinking about terrible wizards.
Listen, just from what I know about the design team, since I work so closely with the lead designer on a bunch of different products, there's absolutely no way that there's going to be any ivory tower design in this classes. If I know Owen, he has probably stayed up way too late in the office tinkering with the theoretical numbers behind this class, stressing about what it's going to look like when it hits the play testers, let alone the final book. So I'm really optimistic. I'm super optimistic, actually.
All right. Well,
I'm so optimistic that I shouldn't be talking about dystopias, actually.
Yes. So let's get roundabout to that. Alex, why do you hate the Pact Worlds?
Oh, I don't hate the Pact Worlds. I think the Pact Worlds are a cool place for an adventure. But I think that, like many actual real-world dystopias, the Pact Worlds are presented as being a lot better than they actually are.
How do you mean? The Pact Worlds are awesome. It's got Skittermanders in it, and lizards, and pop bands.
Technically, they don't have Skittermanders in it. They're native to the Vescarium, not the Pact Worlds.
Well, the Vescarium imported them.
Did they, though? But that aside, I think that one of the major things that when you look at the Starfinder setting that is a huge indication that it is likely a corporate dystopia is just looking at how items are priced in this game. Because I mean, like, from a realist standpoint, almost every argument I'm going to make here that claims that the Pact Worlds is a corporate dystopia is probably intentionally designed that way, because the rules need to be able to survive the players impacting them. Mm-hmm. And it's just true. Mm-hmm. And there are also a bunch of different factors that lead to this setting feeling like a dystopia. And I don't know, I might be able to convince you or I might not. But in my heart, until I see some more information, it's always going to be a dystopia. And the first thing that makes me think the Pact Worlds is a dystopia is actually flavor, not mechanics, believe it or not.
Okay.
When you read the Absalom entry, both in the Pact Worlds book and in the back of the first AP volume, The Incident on Absalom Station, it flat out tells you that monetary... gosh, I can't think of the D word for it. Inequality. No, it was an I word. Income inequality is huge on Absalom Station, right? Mm-hmm. You read all about how you have these corporate elites living in their fancy Jatambi parks and all these Starfinders in their Lorespire citadels. But, like, the majority of the population lives in, like, the lower decks that are infested with monsters, and it literally says that they are in, like, destitute conditions. And we're only talking about 2 million people on this space station, according to all the sources. So, like, that makes me think that we're talking about a couple million people that are, like, at literally the heart of the government. Like, this would be like if Washington, D.C. was massively income inequalities. Spoiler alert, it is, but I'm not going to get political here. The book flat out says that this city that is supposed to be the shining jewel of the government has extreme inequality. And I think that's a good place to start. Want to start pushing back against my thoughts.
I mean, I can side with you on, I can see that point, but at the same time, we can say the same thing about Seattle and many of our friends that live there, some of our friends that live in Seattle live in rather unideal circumstances, or go down south a little bit to San Francisco, where it is quickly becoming your only two choices are to be a tech billionaire or homeless. And
you might not want to keep going with this, like these examples in America, because you might not like the thing that I rebut that with.
I'm just saying that none of us have yet to go Katniss Everdeen on some folk yet.
And you know what? It looks like the Starfinder world is in that position too, because for the most part, you do not have many people that are in outright rebellion over like Abadar Corp. Like Abadar Corp, they are rich enough to go and fund an entire town in a Starfinder society scenario. Right. They're like, oh yeah, this. Oh, that's another thing. Let's talk about Akaton. Right? Mm-hmm. Akaton is a major nation in the Pack Worlds, right? I mean, like, granted, the concept of nations is gone. It's mostly planets. Mm-hmm. So, but let's assume that the role of a planet within the Pack Worlds is similar to the role of a nation within the EU. I think that is a pretty fair comparison. What do you guys think?
Okay, I think that's fair.
I think it's closer to NATO in how it's supposed to be formed, but with the inclusion of trade unions, it makes it seem more like the EU, but the EU is also not a defense pact, which the Absalom Pact is.
Yeah, so let's say that it's like a mix between the EU and NATO.
It's like the Moscow pact, that's what it is.
Yeah, so the thing is like, you know, if you have these people that are in a big allegiance, like usually the idea is that if one of the members is suffering, they're going to offer aid to them, right? That's a fundamental part of the EU. Well, in theory, it's supposed to be. And yet you have this planet that has been in an economic down spiral for 300 years to the point where like cities have basically fallen apart and the entire planet is in anarchy. And they're supposed to be one of the major like areas where the Pack World, like the major supporters of the Pack Worlds, like, to me, the fact that they're willing to let this entire planet just be filled with literally destitute conditions where the only people who have any money are major churches that come down and are like, hey, yo, you small town, these players, they did some helpful things for us, so we're just going to make it rain in your town. I guess we'll push. Abadar Corp is Amazon. They're like, oh, we're just going to put our shipping our shipping supply here because these players helped us out, so we're going to make you into our shipping hub. And now all of a sudden there's one rich place in the entirety of Akaton, and it's this one place where Abadar Corp decided to spend their money.
I don't think anybody praised Amazon.
No, hopefully not.
I mean, I hope not, but
delivery.
That doesn't change the fact that the Abadar Corp is this massively multi-billion credit company that is rich enough to make literal business suits into armor. And they're able to literally, like, you read in at the end of this one scenario that I'm not going to spoil the name of, but it's like a really early one. To the point where, like, if you look at the titles, you can probably guess which one it is. But, like, at the end of this scenario, they're basically like, yeah, they start rolling in the building facilities, and things already got better. Like, they had the capacity to make things better in the span of weeks, and they didn't. Like, and either that means the Pack World's government has no money and can't actually support and improve the places that are within their world and keep the citizens happy and healthy and protect their goals and needs, or they just don't care to. Which is the definition of a dystopia to me.
That was something I was going to come around to, is what the actual definition of dystopia is, because it is a little open-ended. You see a lot of examples of dystopias, whether they be places that are economic instability and inequality can be an example of one. But whenever I think of dystopias, I think of more totalitarianism. And that doesn't necessarily go in hand with corporatism.
I definitely agree that the Pack World is not a totalitarian regime. Like, they are absolutely not. For the most part, like, the leaders of the Pack Worlds, we don't even really know their names. I don't think that the people who are in charge of, like, representing the planets of the Pack Worlds are even named at any point.
So I double-checked to make sure I remembered all this. Do you know the ruling structure of how the Pact, or at least the Absalom Pact, works?
Yeah, isn't it that all the planets send a representative of their governments over, and they use that to like as like a defense treaty kind of thing?
Nope. Every planet, every member gets a number of representatives proportional to the numbers of sentient species on that planet.
So individuals or species?
The individuals of each sentient species on that planet.
So it's like the House of Representatives.
Right, so like Castrovel, for instance, would probably have Lashunta, Formian, Elf. Who's that last one? Lashunta, Formian, Elf. I'm missing Kasatha. One. No, those are all three. Sorry, Kasatha also get because the Adari's a member of it as well. And then there's another six-person elected body. Although the six-person or five-person elected body, and the six-person is the stewards, like leader, and they're kind of like the Security Council. How's that works? Where they kind of like final say on things. So there's a lot of representatives coming to make these decisions.
Right. So then why is Akaton still dirt poor with absolutely no support?
So the way that they that Absalom Station or the Absalom Pact is presented, it says a military pact and they regulate trade. Every place inside of it is more of a confederation rather than a union. Mm-hmm. So the EU, for instance, has a standard currency as a way to help strengthen the whole area. It seems like each planet is kind of left on its own. Mm-hmm. And there's certain transplanetary laws, but every place is free to govern itself and it can request aid. But if you have a place that isn't centralized to begin with, it might be hard to get enough people to petition on your behalf.
Yeah, especially if you take a look at Eox as a counterexample. A lot of the Pact Worlds Alliance actively dislikes a lot of what goes down at Eox, to the point that a lot of its entertainment streams are out and out banned in the rest of the planets. But they're completely free to self-govern, so, I mean, I feel bad for the other planet, but the Pact World was not designed to be a humanitarian mission. It was a desperate alliance for military, and it's on that planet to fix itself.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, I would like, you know, if I lived there, I would totally want different... My chair hates me. I would totally want some, you know, more beneficial alliances, etc. But the fact that income inequality exists doesn't bring us quite to dystopia yet. It's bad times, but income inequality is the entire history of the human race, and it's been bad and worse in different situations, but the entire history of the human race has not been a dystopia, because the dystopia has to be worse than normal, and therefore the default can't be a dystopia. It has to be just normal. So you can't compare something to what is just what we're used to dealing with as a species and then call it the dystopia. That would be like me saying that, you know, just because the Nevada desert is crappy, we're in an apocalypse.
I don't know if I agree with that particular statement. Yeah, I don't agree with that particular example. I do think that, like, I feel like the word dystopia isn't the right word to use to describe how I feel about the Pact Worlds, but ultimately, I think that it's a place that is honestly pretty not great to live in. I think that a lot of the artwork and the way that things are presented try to make it seem like it's almost like the Federation in Star Trek, when like most of it really isn't. Most of it is pretty like crappy. Like, as a great example, I'm going to now switch over and talk about some rules mechanics.
Yeah.
This is absolutely my favorite point to talk about, because when we talk about the rules, it's easy to say, oh, well, you know, the NPCs don't follow the same rules as everybody else does, right? And I think that that's kind of cheating, in a sense, because if you're going to have a world and you're going to put rules into it, then the assumption is that everybody should be playing by similar rules. I think it's one thing to say, like, it's okay to be like, all right, well, we build these characters differently. But, like, if a check to perform a day job is different for NPCs than for players, that's kind of cheap, because that's a fundamental action that you're doing. That's not like your baseline ability toolkit. And ultimately, I think that one of the greatest indications that maybe the Pact Worlds isn't so great and is like horribly has a horrible inequality, and the majority of people don't have enough money to live on, is you don't have to look any further than the profession skill. Because how the profession skill is worded is this is for the day jobs task of the profession skill. Essentially, how it works is that you make a day job check, you double the result, and that's how much credits you earn for a week of work, right? So if we're looking at first level, and now this is assuming that the majority of NPCs aren't operatives, because these numbers will be different for operatives, obviously, because they get massive skill bonuses. But when we're looking at the general monster building rules, as a general rule, you get like not a great bonus at first level. It's like a plus 10, if I'm remembering it correctly. I'm actually going to look it up on the Archives of Nethys just so that I can make sure that I'm right, because I really don't want to be wrong in an argument. call me selfish if you want, but I really don't want to be.
So selfish.
I am so selfish. It's true. Oh no, the Archives of Nethys doesn't have the array stats. That makes me sad. I just wanted the tables. Oh well. I'll look it up later then. I think the number is plus 10 because I was looking at it earlier this afternoon. And let's assume that it is plus 10 for this. But if somebody in chat who's listening live on our Twitch stream wants to correct me by ripping open a copy of the Alien Archive, please do, and I'll update my response. But regardless of that, let's assume that it's about plus 10. That means that you're rolling a check, and your average check, your average paycheck that you're bringing home is going to be a 20 modified. So like a 10 on the die plus 10 from your bonus. That's a 20, which means for a week's worth of work, you're going to earn about 40 credits.
Okay.
So that's like, oh, cool. That's 40 credits. And I'm not going to be the person who tries to compare credits to dollars. That's more of James's thing in his awesome blog, Code Switch. Oh, look, Jen McTeague says in chat, first level expert array gives plus 10 for a master skill. So I'm assuming that you are the best of the best at your job, clearly. And so that means you'd have an average of a 20 on your typical die. You double that to 40. And so you're like, okay, I have 40 credits in my pocket. This is pretty cool. Except it's really not that great for you. Things are not going to look good. Because assuming that you are going out and buying your meals, let's say you want a good meal, because if you click on, if you read the common meal category, the common meals are like tasty and nourishing. They're general things you'd want to eat. Whereas the good meals are like gourmet and great. And common meals is like eating stuff that is either tasty but not healthy for you, or healthy for you but doesn't taste good. So assuming you're going to buy a good quality meal, the price for a good quality meal is or not a good quality meal, a common quality meal is 3 credits. That means that you can buy just shy of about 12 meals a week, we'll say. And if you're buying 12 meals a week, you're going to want to eat 3 times a day for most people. That means that you have a full day's worth of meals 4 days a week as a first level character buying your food. And that's assuming you spend your entire paycheck on your food. Like, that's not counting, like, you know, we'll say that you're living in Absalom Station and you could walk to work or use public transportation, assuming there is public transportation, because there is nothing for free in the vehicle section that says that you can just hop on a bus and get anywhere. You got to pay by the mile for most of them. But so that's assuming that, you know, you have no bills for, like, your rent where you're living. You're never buying any new equipment. You're never buying any personal commodities or luxuries. You're not even buying a hygiene kit. Like, you're getting 4 meals a week, or three full days of meals a week, and that's your entire paycheck at first level on average. Like, you'd have to perform exemplary to get more than that. So, like, I guess the other option is that maybe, like, it's a, like a meritocracy where, like, your level is actually how good you are at your job if you're an NPC, and so higher levels mean higher bonuses, which means higher pay. But pay from doing a job like this is not quadratic. It's not going to go up like significantly like it does in the real world. It is a very short line. And by the time that you're max level and you have that plus 20 and you're rolling your day job and you're getting a 30, you're not even breaking 100 credits a week at 20th level. So no. So where's all this money coming from for the most part?
I also, this is kind of in your favor here, Alex. I looked at the freelancer array, right? And it's your skill rank times 2 is the average cost of hiring a freelancer for a skill.
So that means you're paying that freelancer like less than that. Nobody's making money in the pack world.
Well, that like, tracks actually.
Like, where are people buying stuff? So like, and from a game design perspective, this makes sense. The game designers do not want the ability to sit in Absalom Station and roll checks every week to be able to be a good way for players to earn equipment and items. But when you get right down to it, like, this is not enough money.
Okay. this is where I need to blow a hole in your theory.
Go ahead and try, Param.
Okay, this is easy because I has math.
Okay.
All right. So the average income for a household in the United States right now is a little over $40,000. Okay. So that means, and right now, an average household has 2 working people in it. So your
you better stop right here because you know that you're going to get me really angry if you continue with this.
Okay. So So that means that the average person, especially, is going to earn about $20,000 a year. That's a little bit above minimum wage. It's not quite what we'd like it to be, and we're not going to get into the politics of American economy right now. That means that, on average, their take-home pay is going to be around $1,000 a month. Mm-hmm. And so that is $250 a week. Now, a good meal, if you define that as a good meal, and eating out at a restaurant for a good meal, which is what that chart is supposed to represent, not you buying supplies.
It doesn't. It represents the cost of buying a meal at a store. I know because I wrote those rules.
Okay.
But
so,
it doesn't say that. It says getting them at a restaurant.
But,
it says
but the armory has restaurant rules that are different.
Yeah, well, you can hide behind your technicalities of writing it, but...
Mm-hmm. All right, so even buying a good meal is still... We'll shift it over there. Buying a good meal. That will cost me, on average, when I want to cook myself up a good meal, and I don't do a lot of freaking cooking, honestly, but I buy a lot of food for people to do it for me frequently. That's going to be about $10 a person if you're doing it right, and like you're cooking some good steak, or you've got some really great pasta going with all the sides and fixings.
You can buy good steak for $10
a person, a serving. Yeah, you can.
I'm going to the wrong steak places then.
Well, I mean, this is a
wait, hold on. You need to decide whether or not you're talking about restaurants or groceries, because I had to shift to groceries because of your argument about groceries. If you want me to switch back to restaurants,
I can't go to a grocery store and buy that.
Good Lord, where are you shopping?
I guess all the wrong places is what I said.
Yeah.
All right. So next, okay. So you do that. So even if we say it's about $10 a person for a good meal, you're looking at barely. So that's $30 a day for a good meal. So you in the real world, you get to stretch yourself out to what? 30 times 7. You get to make it through the week with nothing left over. So you're just barely being able to make it.
But that's not true. Mm-hmm. Because you calculated your income assuming that you had a working household with two people, which means you have to double that food price.
Okay,
because you can't let your significant other starve while you feast on the glory.
It doesn't matter because it just makes it a ratio. You just increase it by two.
Mm-hmm. I increase it by two, but I also increase Alex, math. If I increase the food price by two, I also have to circle in their income. Mm-hmm. So two,
which you did, didn't you?
No.
It was $10 for the meal.
For the meal per person.
Yeah.
And we're assuming an income of two. I'm not talking about if they got kids, because then things get wonky. So we do that. And okay, so they make it a little bit better off in the real world, but not by a huge margin. You're still not able to live on it if you do it that way, by those prices. That's why common meal is called common. It's what we actually feed ourselves. So what's the price for a common meal, Alex?
That was the price. It was 3 credits per person. Oh, for common meal? Oh, that's 1 credit per person.
Oh, so then everything becomes much more affordable.
Well, then what's the price of a common meal in the real world, then?
Like less than $5 a person, if you're fixing it yourself.
So I don't think that going down to a meal that flat out says it either is disgusting or of no nutritional value is necessarily a great like counterpoint, saying that everything is fine and dandy. Because, I mean, I feel like James can talk better than this, being a nutritionist in his day job, but at least in a lot of the conversations we have...
Can you read the description of the common meal again?
I mean, I will in a second. Go ahead, Alex. Finish up.
Yeah, well, you said poor meal the first time, didn't you?
No, I have not gone to poor meal yet.
Because poor meal is 1 credit per person, but a common meal is 3 credits per person.
Okay.
Yeah. Sorry, I thought you said core. Yeah, because if we're talking good meals, like the really high quality stuff, that's 5 credits per person. But What I was saying is that just because food is cheap and affordable doesn't mean that you can use the fact that people are eating food that either it tastes bad and therefore gives them a low quality of life because they're not happy with the food they're eating, or tastes great but is non-nutritious, meaning that they're not healthy. I don't think you can use that as a real like judge of, hey, everything is fine and dandy. And at least in a lot of the conversations James and I have had, it almost sounds like that's a good indicator of like poverty level stuff right there.
Okay. Well, then we have the other argument of, well, that's kind of life where we're living right now, Alex.
Yeah, I mean, it can be. So part of it is, you know what meals are nutrition, but nutritionally pretty broad but bland? Norwegian food. like, even if the quality of ingredients is good, sometimes there is a taste preference inside of a group.
Mm-hmm.
As far, like, I just have to look at the core rulebook meals that say they come from a restaurant or a street vendor. In general, you think you'd be able to get cheaper, but it's just not written there because grocery rules would be super boring. Like, right. Turbo boring.
Wait. So the core rulebook says it comes from a restaurant or street vendor.
Right.
Okay. So I don't care if you wrote it, Alex. You got edited just like everybody else. So your argument gets invalidated there. They're specifically saying
invalidated. There's still some issues with it, but
yeah.
I don't think.
So the second we do that, then we get to double the real world prices for food.
Yeah, I mean, in general, if you go to a restaurant, whatever you pay, it costs a third of that to make. That's your general restaurant, like, back end of math.
Right.
So using the rules from Starfinder, though, we can say that in Starfinder, if you're crafting items, the crafting cost of anything is 90% of it. Like, that's a hard encoded in the game. So if you're using the life science skills to make food, which is actually a use of the life science skill, that means that you would be able to buy it at 90%, which is, for that good quality meal, is 4.5 credits per, about 2.6, 2.7 for the common, and 0.9 for the good. But this also comes with a problem with the fact that Starfinder doesn't have a binary currency system the way that we do as in America, where our dollars break down into cents. Because there isn't that, we're not really sure whether you can even buy ingredients in that cost, or like whether fractional credits really exist. Other countries in the world that don't use a dual currency system, like Japan, they just change it by having the numbers be really big, which is why you hear things about like tens of thousands of yen only being like a couple thousand dollars in the United States, not because the currency is devalued, but because they don't further break it down into cents.
Okay, so if there is... Okay, so I'm going to... You make an interesting rules argument on that point there, but... If you're selling something for three of something and it's a whole meal, the society does not even function if you can't subdivide that.
So, I mean, is that an economic problem with the pack worlds then? Please explain, Perrin, because if the currency is broken, that could be a sign of a very not great society.
No, I'm saying that it's not possible for the society to exist,
I
want to
jump on that currency bandwagon.
Go ahead.
The currency in Starfinder is kind of not great. Going back to this, the currency issue, the currency, the credit itself, it's so widely accepted, but it's also as a one-to-one trade with UPBs, which are your like universal material, and other trade goods that aren't UPBs. And that's essentially kind of what a gold standard was, except the gold standard still could float based on the value of the weight of gold, whereas it seems like these trade goods are pretty standard. If you know, there's a 1,000 UPBs in one bulk. Like, the currency just does not work as how currency should, even if it's a fiat currency, where it's backed by the faith in what a credit is worth. Because then that static prices things like minerals and other trade goods that are in the rule book.
And so, like, I could even buy it as being a static number between worlds and the pack worlds, but it implied pretty heavily that it's a static number between, like, the pack worlds and the Vescarium and the pack worlds and the Aslanti Star Empire.
Who like, hates them.
Yeah, and it's like, okay, why are you not dramatically... why are you not engaging in a trade war with the Pack Worlds, Aslantes? And it, boosting up the price of yourself. Like, why are you guys not charging for use of the Starstone? Or, like, do you guys? I feel like in one of the books, they talk about how, like, there are people who don't want to let non-humans use the Starstone or something.
Yeah. Like, There's something about non-Galarian people from or races from Galarian not wanting other people to use the Starstone because it's their destined item. And I was going to make that joke about Abadar coin.
Yeah, Abadar coin.
As a crypto.
If anybody had a cryptocurrency, it'd be Abadar Corp. It really would. Yeah, it's pretty cray. Also, have you guys noticed that in Starfinder, like, generally speaking, there are no luxuries that are more than a couple hundred credits, but weapons can range into, like, millions and millions. And, like, I know that in the real world that's somewhat true as well, that weapons are just crazy expensive, but...
Not really.
Like, no. Like, I can buy a gun for, like, $50 if I know where to ask.
Yeah, but are you getting a level 1 gun, or are you getting, like, the really high item level 6 gun?
Oh, no, I'm getting a level 1 gun. For $50, I'm getting a level 1 gun.
Yeah, I could probably get a rifle for about 50. Right. I'd probably pay more for Fallout 76 than I would a rifle.
Wait, is that before the price nerfs or after the price nerfs? Because it's down to like $35 now.
I mean, don't remind me, but before the price nerfs.
Yeah. It's
funny.
It was. I owned that game for 4 days, and I bought it on release day. Before the price nerf.
As far as, like, the item levels in weapons, like, that's a hard transfer to make. Because, man, weapons on Earth aren't actually that much different from each other.
And this is where we need to pivot, because the rules-based argument for the economy dystopia is fun and all. But the official on-record answer when any time we talk about Pathfinder or Starfinder economies and how they work is Starfinder is not an economic simulation. It is a simulation about shooting lasers in space, and it does that very well, and everything else is hand-waved.
I agree with you to an extent, because Pathfinder First Edition and its predecessor 3.5 did a decent job of at least making a pricing system for, like, peasants and stuff that made
sense. They did that completely by accident, and they admit it.
I mean, that's fair, but they could have totally done it again.
Like, it also doesn't actually work, because if you read the three in Pathfinder, they go by the common saying of a worker makes a silver a day, and the only way the economy actually works is if you're using the skill system, which they say NPCs don't.
I mean, I agree with you. You're right. That particular rule was wrong. But when you look at, like, the in-game rules, and, like, again, I think that... And that was one of the original posits that I made, that if you're going to base things off of rules for players, it should be based off of them for NPCs, too. Mm-hmm. And if you use the profession rules, like, a player could make a living and have, like, an okay standard of living and watch that living go up. They wouldn't be able to buy all the really cool magical treasures or anything with that money. But, I mean, that sort of works. But I guess the difference is that in the modern world, we expect people to be able to work and, like, you know, have jobs and, like, be powerful business people and use that to pull in huge amounts of money. And that's not something you could really do in Starfinder. And, again, like, I understand why it would be game-breaking to be able to be Jeff Bezos, the player character. Mm-hmm. Like, being able to make 14,000 credits a second or whatever. But, like... The fact that the rules don't, like, have a place where they say this can be a thing is weird, and it sort of adds to this overall feeling of dystopia. Like, I wish there was a thing that said, like, oh, by the way, if you work a job, then you get a quality of life, and that quality of life is an additional money in addition to your check that you automatically spend to, like, not be in poverty. And if they did that, it would have been fine. But with what we're given, like, the world is painted as a dystopia. Like, you don't have enough money for anything but the barest of necessities. And getting higher level doesn't necessarily fix that. You're kind of reliant on big corporations dropping massive bonuses on you, which actually is scary, similar to how the video game industry works. You guys can't see me, but my mind is blown. Like, oh gosh, because that's basically how they do it. They give people, like, almost no money for their profits, and then if games are successful, they just drop bonuses. That's what the Starfinder Society does. Oh my god, the entire world is just a video game corporate. And oh my god, it's the worst of dystopias. It's worse than a dystopia. It's oh god.
I just want to end on this. The restaurants just physically don't work by how the currency system works. You would not make enough of a profit margin. Heck, a supermarket would fail with that low margin of profit between cost of creation and value of creation.
Mm-hmm. Oh, absolutely.
The only thing that would work is stock exchanging.
Yeah, right. Getting futures against a currency that doesn't change value? Yeah, let's do that.
So... I guess when we started this, James said, like, hey, how are we defining dystopia? Right. At least for me, A dystopia is a system of government that inherently is flawed to the point where it does not work as intended. Like, America is arguably, to many people, not great right now. And I think that that's a joke that we've all been making throughout the entire stream as Americans. But at least, like, a lot of the institutions that we have are working and they're doing their jobs as they're supposed to. To me, like, the type of dystopia I'm talking about is a place where those inherent systems are flawed to the point where they're not doing their job. So, like, if you can't make enough money to buy a house, I would consider that to be pretty not great. And, like, but, like, to the point where, like, the money system and, like, major businesses theoretically don't work. Like, who is propping all of these people up? There's probably just, like, a group of really rich people who had tons of money after the gap, and they just bought everything, and it's on their dime that the system works. But without knowing that for certain, like, I would just argue that, like, economics don't really work as written, and because economics don't work, people should all be in poverty, and because they should all be in poverty, that is my personal definition of a dystopia. But I would like to hear you two counter me again, because it's fun.
Okay, well, I can. If you're going to keep leaning on the economic rules don't work, I say that the laws of physics don't work because the peasant railgun still works in Starfinder.
The what?
Oh, that's okay. Who cares about that?
Well, I'm just the saying peasant... that we can't model things about the way you can model game rules that are not intended to be used in function you're using them.
Do you know why that actually doesn't work? Because the game doesn't calculate damage of past objects via
exponential
scale.
I know that the actual damage of the peasant railgun doesn't work, but you're still able to move a log a mile in 6 seconds.
But the peasant railgun isn't in Starfinder. That's a Pathfinder thing.
No, you can still do this chain of readied actions.
Yeah, like you can still do the actions in Starfinder. So yeah, no, you don't magically launch the log into space and atomize somebody. You are able to teleport a potion from one end of a football field to the other in 6 seconds.
I think that is an inherently flawed counter because it's basically saying, well, this aspect of the game doesn't... You're saying one aspect of the game doesn't work. This other aspect of the game doesn't work. And we therefore, your point doesn't matter because nothing works.
Okay, like, so no. My argument is not that. It is that that aspect of the game doesn't work when you don't use the rules as intended to them to be used. And you're currently trying to use the rules as intended to be as a way they're not intended to be used. Because, and we repeat... Starfinder is not meant to be an economic simulation. It's never meant to be an economic simulation. The entirety of the economy of how the world actually works is written in the fluff of the world, not in its rules calculations on skill checks.
Right.
So but you're using a rule that's meant to just be how players spend their downtime and trying to apply it to all of society.
Well, I would agree with you if the flavor actually said how people make money in the world, which it doesn't. So we're left to assume that it's through the skills and the game mechanics that are in the game, because we do know that peasants use those same rules. They are not peasants, that normal people use those same rules, like, because they all have skill bonuses and stuff. And
they have skill bonuses, but you say... Okay, that argument is fundamentally flawed because you say that we don't know how they make money because it hasn't stated. And then you're saying that it's stated that they use the skill bonuses, which is never stated anywhere either.
That's true. But so, it is stated, but it's a use of the skill that says in the second pronoun, you can do this thing.
Right.
Wait. Because that doesn't work either. Because just because it uses the word you, and that's player facing skill rules, nobody would ever second guess whether an NPC can use acrobatics to walk across a tightrope, or whether an NPC can use a engineering to rig explosives to explode, or whether an NPC could use the bluff skill to feint a player in combat. They can use skills. Mm-hmm. Like, just because the rules don't say specifically NPCs use this skill to earn money doesn't mean that they don't. They can use any skill players can do because we watch them do it in combat, because if they didn't, then they would need special abilities to do feigning and stuff, which they don't need. They just use those baseline rules.
But you know what they do have? Tons of special abilities that players aren't able to access. And you know... The equivalent of Starfinder's Jeff Bezos exists, because they do exist. How does Abadar Kor exist under the simulation that's provided under Starfinder? Because there's no way to do it. Therefore, the NPCs do not use your economy. because they're written that they exist. They can't exist using your rules. Therefore, they didn't.
Well, I mean,
that was a very, if you would have started by saying it that way, Param, yeah, that would have been a lot better.
Yeah. Like, if you had started with that, that would have been a lot harder for me to counter.
But well, now it is the argument. You have to counter it.
You kind of found it as you stumbled there.
Right. So this is true that we don't know exactly how they're going to get all of this money and how it's working. But the point that I'm making is that the system clearly does not work for the majority of people. And all of the NPCs that we have seen written so far don't have any special abilities that allow them to amass lots of money. So I think that, you know, using your own argument that NPCs have special abilities that players don't have, there could be NPCs that run the entire economy that we haven't seen yet that have these special abilities. But the point is that the rules as written do not support the economy. Therefore, the average NPC that we have seen, every NPC that has ever been printed, could not actually survive in this economy. They would all be starved.
This is kind of going back to a thematical, but I think also the point of dystopia goes to two places, which are Akaton and Absalom Station.
Right.
Places like Castrovel, Triaxius, Versus, they're all pretty well off as far as their depictions. In fact, Versus is depicted as a post-scarcity society where people work because it's something to do.
Right.
Yeah. And I agree with that, which is really funny because it's like the opposite of Absalom Station, which is kind of like the capital, which has horrible income inequality. You would think they'd all just move to Versus, really.
I mean, but you don't get the Starstone.
Mm-hmm. It's true. And that's fine. The Starstone can just float in outer space and just be a beacon on a dead spaceship, and everyone can just go live in the post-scarcity society.
So I mean, there's a very small amount of space because of the sun.
That's true.
So the best argument we can come up with then is that by what's written in the Pact Worlds and paying attention to the fluff, that Absalom Station is definitely dystopian, so is Akaton, but the Pact Worlds as a whole isn't.
I would argue that if the place that is going to represent your nation, which, let's face it, Verses doesn't represent the Pact Worlds. That's one planet out of all of them. Hmm. The place that represents the Pact Worlds is Akaton. Nobody cares if everybody in Silicon Valley is doing well, which isn't true, but nobody cares if everybody in like one county in the United States is doing well, if all over that isn't true. And in the place where you look as like the center of their culture and their heritage, that place is doing poorly. That sort of reflects negatively on everybody. You know, I agree with you that there are places that are clearly better than others in the Pact Worlds, but that's true of any dystopia. And, you know, if you were lucky enough to get born into Verses, awesome. You live in a post-scarcity society, but like, Why aren't people traveling there? Why isn't there more immigration? Is something stopping them? We don't really know.
We don't know, but also Absalom Station is a small area with finite space. Its population is dwarfed by those on other planets. It is the place. You don't think that you wouldn't think that the UN is a poor representative because there's trash in front of the building in New York City. Like, it's too small of a sample size, I think, to compare to other places, or to compare as a full capital. Because, that's where legislation comes from, but it's actually not where most of the people that are under this protective umbrella live.
Yeah. So what's the population balances? I mean, like, how does Absalom Station and Akaton population compare to the total of
Absalom City is about 2.6 million, I think, is the number we went through last episode.
Mm-hmm.
And generally speaking, I don't remember Versi's number off the top of my head. Castrovel, most of the major cities have about 2 million people as well. So Absalom Station is essentially a major city on most of these other really well-to-do planets that are just floating in the cosmos. Mm-hmm. Like, it's about the size of a big city, a metropolis, and that's about it.
Yeah.
I can see your point that maybe using Absalom Station as a sample size, despite its prominence in the setting, might not be the absolute best short stick to go. But despite that, I mean, you've named two planets out of what, 10? Mm-hmm. Like, try to convince me that Albalon isn't awful. It's pretty bad. Like, if any planet is authoritarian, it's Albalon.
So Avalon is authoritarian, but it doesn't seem like that is far from the intended goal of it, especially with how the races that live there are presented. There's really just two sides, those who wait for their creators to come back and those who want to become the creators. And you have just a planned system and an economy with a group of with a species that wants to go towards that way. Mm-hmm. Kind of like the mollusk people that worship the devil. They're viewed as this, we're all going to stay in line. That's a little more dystopian.
The devils, there's more than one.
Right, right. I'm sorry. I didn't mean to offend Mammon.
Mammon is very offended. We don't need him on this show again, Jake.
But there's a split in ideology here, and it I hate giving the thing that robots are inherently logical, but that is what is presented with from Abalon, from that perspective, that everything goes towards one of those two ideologies and whatever else kind of gets put to the side unless it can be accomplished without damaging that whole.
Okay.
Because also the members of the Pack Worlds are it's a little weird because most moons aren't their own states. Mm-hmm. They're usually part of their governing body, except for Octurn? No.
I forget. Feel also, like most of the moons that orbit Bezthara, mm-hmm. the big gas giant, I thought most of them were independent.
They're independent protectorates administered by the planet of Bethda. Or you know what I mean. The only one that's separate is Kala Mahoy, stingray fish person planet.
Kala, yeah.
Kala, yeah. The other ones are ones, actually...
The one pop star wears a fishbowl on her head. It's mm-hmm, great.
Mm-hmm. But the other ones are actually just a protectorate of somebody else. Also, the Aspis Consortium is a self-governing member, which is funny.
Where are they based off of?
Nowhere. They were given it as a role for their help with the swarm. So kind of like how I think it's the Knights of St. John. There's a knightly order from like the Middle Ages that has a observer status at the UN, even though it doesn't have any territory. So it's kind of like that.
Huh. That's mm-hmm. interesting.
Mm-hmm. I mean, some places suck. Octurn sucks. Apostate mm-hmm. sucks. Mm-hmm. but those places that suck within their expectation of suck. And if you are not on the winning part of that suck, it is a dystopia. Because dystopia really is a perspective idea of negativity. Because mm-hmm. there's no positive dystopia. In fact, those are called utopias.
Uh-huh. Well, I'm saying dystopia is supposed to be all over the average experience is crap. Because if it's just what we're normally used to dealing with as a society in mm-hmm. like today and in our normal lives throughout the majority of modern history, we can't call it a dystopia because it would just be a society.
So then what real world societies would you consider our dystopias, Param?
Okay, so
I thought we were going to stay away from getting political. What's happening here? So well, no, here's North Korea, nobody cares. They don't have the internet. They won't hear that.
Yeah. Okay. So if North Korea was the entirety of Earth, then it would be dystopian. Or you could say that if you lived in North Korea, it would be a dystopian society because you have the requisite everything is generally bad and unpleasant to live there, and that
all your world
you have a totalitarian regime. So those fit the two definitions of dystopia.
Your definition doesn't work though, because one of the things you highlighted was that a dystopia has to be like everybody agrees that this is bad. But you know, we have records from people who are in North Korea who are okay with the system and what it's like.
No. So I didn't say everyone. I said most people.
But do most people? Yeah, but do most? I mean, like we know that there are defectors. There are documentaries of people defecting North Korea to South Korea, mm-hmm. but the majority of people don't. Is that really horrible for everybody? Like, there are lots of people there who are raised to believe that their leader is awesome, their government is great, and everyone else is out to get them.
Yeah, and so they're starving.
By your definition, can a dystopia only be in hindsight? Because that's almost what sounds like what you're saying, because no matter what experience you're living in a government, there's always going to be people who think it's okay, which means by your definition, a dystopia can never be in the present tense.
I'm saying the dystopia is a dystopia to the outside observer.
Right. And so I'm the outside observer for the Pack Worlds, and I'm telling you this is a dystopia.
So it's a phenomenon that has to be observed. Okay. Yeah. And I think where we're at is just there are aspects of places that are dystopian, and it's just not an overall dystopia. And even though corporate power gets a lot of play mm-hmm. in the Starfinder universe, it seems like they're the primary benefactor on certain worlds, and on other worlds, they seem to have a little more liberty. I mean, right. It is a kitchen sink type of setting. You got your cyberpunk, you got your robot mm-hmm. world, you got your terrible death moon.
It's a terrible Death Moon?
Planet, you know what I mean.
Yeah. Eox is a total dystopia if you're a living person.
Yeah. Yeah.
Well, I mean, I'd argue that Absalom Station is a total dystopia if you're poor, and
Oh, Agaton, yeah, totally.
It's a total dystopia if you're poor, and Albalon is total dystopia if you're living.
I will also say, I don't think being poor is inherently makes you unhappy.
No.
Like, That's fair. It kind of sucks.
I accept that.
Yeah. you can be happy to live in a place where you get to see all sorts of things, get a lot of new opportunities for job, and it sucks that you have to go sleep on a mattress and eat beans and rice all day, but, you know, you balance out one experience for another.
All right. Well, we are running out of time, everyone, so we got a couple of shout-outs. Make sure that you are listening to our Actual Play podcasts, plural. We've got.
We have two.
We have two running right now. One is Seasons Beatings with GM Alex and a fantastic group of players. It is our holiday podcast, and it is going to be airing through the holiday season. The other podcast is Adventurous, which has returned with new episodes. The first of the new episodes aired on Monday, and if you've been watching the live streams, you've actually been seeing many of those episodes recorded. So those of you that watch the live streams are ahead of the curve a little bit here, but it will be releasing weekly on Mondays. So please tune into our Discord chat, which you can join us on nodirectionpodcast.com. You can go to the Discord link there. Also, if you want to reach us, you can do so at facebook.com/nodirection. We have our YouTube page at youtube.com/nodirectionshow. And, of course, our Twitter at twitter.com/nodirection. So reach out to us there. And we would also like to thank our Patreon patrons who keep this content and more content like it going. Without you, we couldn't do this. So thank you all very much for your support. Until next time, go beyond with no direction.